Eggman calling in with another tipping-related question.
Hey, Dave, I have a question about tipping when you're traveling in Europe, okay? So, you know, I lived in Italy for almost a year, many years ago. I married a foreigner.
Right.
And we went out to eat often, and they don't tip there, obviously, right? So I'd have a meal, and I would leave a tip. Sometimes I would get a dirty look from the waitstaff for leaving them a 20% tip on top of the meal. I felt weird about tipping.
Right. And so I guess in some countries, when you leave a tip, it's seen as you think the restaurant must be struggling, so you leave them extra money. That's why in some places it's seen as offensive to tip.
And then when I wouldn't tip, because you just don't tip, I'm paying a lot for this meal, I felt like then I would get a dirty look like, dude, we know you're American. You can't come here and not tip.
Yeah.
Americans have to tip here. Only Italians don't have to tip here. So, Dave, have you ever noticed any of those things? Shalom, brother.
Yes, shalom. I have noticed those things. There sometimes is a bit of a double standard on tipping. Again, I'm against tipping. I just like price everything in and I'll decide if it's worth it, you know, and then it avoids all of these travel problems and cultural, you know, inconsistencies on tipping. That being said, I will play the game. I will look up what is expected in each country. And in some countries, it's like, nah, you just round up to the next dollar. Okay. In some countries, it's like 5 to 10% max for good service, but not expected. And I just try to do what's expected. I agree. It's all horrifying. Now, I will say, my experiences in Italy were everybody wants a tip. There was once I stayed at a hotel on the Amalfi coast. And I think there were 6 different opportunities for tips. As soon as I pulled up in my rental car, someone came out and wanted the keys in order to park the car. So that was tip opportunity number 1. Tip opportunity number 2 was the person who insisted on bringing my luggage into the hotel. Tip number 3 was the person who insisted on bringing the luggage from the lobby up to my room. Tip number 4 was the person who came up to the room and insisted on giving me a full tour, including like how light switches and toilets work. It's like, I'm not Trump. I know how toilets work. I'm not going around thinking I have to flush them 10 to 15 times. And 5th opportunity for tipping was when you want the rental car, they put it in a lot where you could easily just walk into the lot and get it, but they get it for you. So it creates a 5th opportunity for leaving a tip. So it was tip crazy in Italy. You should have seen what was going on. All right. Great bonus show for you today. Just trust me. I won't even tease what's on today's bonus show. It's a good one.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best. The smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh, yeah. bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I have been saying from the first day of this crisis that the physical integrity of nuclear facilities is an absolute must. And of course, a missile going astray or something like this could have a very significant impact.
The International Atomic Energy Agency is expressing alarm over reports Russia fired missiles over three Ukrainian nuclear power plants, including the largest nuclear plant in Europe. We'll go to Ukraine for the latest. Then we'll speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ed Yong about how the climate emergency could spark the next pandemic. Then Sunday is May Day, International Workers' Day. We will look at The Wobblies, a film that tells the story of the first union for all workers.
Industrial workers of the world, work, good wages, and respect. That's what they wanted for the workers. To be people, not nobody.
The Wobblies first came out in 1979, but it's just been restored and entered into the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. We'll speak with one of the film directors and air excerpts. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A pair of cruise missiles slammed into a residential high-rise in Kyiv Thursday, injuring 10 people in Russia's first strikes on Ukraine's capital city in nearly 2 weeks. The attack came just hours after United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres toured parts of Kyiv devastated by Russia's invasion just minutes after he'd wrapped up a joint news conference with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky said the timing of the missile attacks showed Russia was seeking to humiliate the United Nations and everything it represents. Guterres reiterated the UN's call for a ceasefire and said his priority is to ensure Moscow and Kyiv set up evacuation and aid corridors in Ukraine that are truly safe.
Today, Ukraine is an epicenter of unbearable heartache and pain. I witnessed that very vividly today around Kyiv. The senseless loss of life, the massive destruction, the unacceptable violations of human rights and the laws of war. It is vital that the International Criminal Court and other UN mechanisms conduct their work so that there can be real accountability.
The German and Austrian energy companies Uniper and OMV say they've agreed to Russia's demands that purchasers of Russian oil and gas open accounts in a Russian bank and pay in rubles. The Italian energy giant Eni is also reportedly in talks to make ruble payments for Russian gas. Earlier this week, the European Union accused Russia of blackmail after it shut off gas supplies to Poland and Bulgaria, which had refused to pay in rubles. The Russian state-controlled firm Gazprom continues to supply Europe with about 40% of the natural gas it consumes. NATO said Thursday it's ready to support Ukraine's military in its fight against Russia for years, if necessary. The military alliance's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg spoke from the 2022 NATO Youth Summit in Brussels Thursday.
There is absolutely the possibility that this war will drag on and last for months and years. NATO allies are preparing to provide support over a long period of time.
In Washington, D.C., President Biden's asked Congress for an additional $33 billion in economic and military assistance to Ukraine. His request came as Congress voted overwhelmingly to revive the Lend-Lease Act that the U.S. used to arm its allies during World War II. Biden's latest request includes $20 billion to purchase new weapons and ammunition, including anti-tank and anti-air systems, helicopters, drones, grenade launchers, and millions in rounds of ammunition. Speaking from the White House, Biden rejected charges that the U.S. is using Ukraine to wage a proxy war against Russia.
We're not attacking Russia. We're helping Ukraine defend itself against Russian aggression. And just as Putin chose to launch this brutal invasion, he could make the choice to end this brutal invasion. Russia is the aggressor. No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Code Pink's Medea Benjamin noted Biden's call for $33 billion for Ukraine is over half the entire budget of the State Department and USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development. Benjamin called Biden's request a down payment on World War III and added, quote, "We need diplomacy, not billions more in weapons." The United Nations warns human activity has damaged and degraded up to 40% of the world's land, reducing the fertility of soil and stripping it of native trees, vegetation, and biodiversity. The report by the UN's Convention to Combat Desertification finds most of the damage is caused by food production, risking the ability of nations to continue feeding Earth's growing population. A new study in the journal Science finds the climate crisis poses the largest risk to marine animals since an asteroid impact wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. The study found about a third of all the animals in the ocean could vanish within 3 centuries unless humanity takes dramatic steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. With strong action to halt the climate crisis, the study found up to 70% of extinctions could be prevented. Meanwhile, a report in the journal Nature finds the climate crisis and urban sprawl are driving wild mammals to relocate to new habitats where they risk spreading novel viruses into the human population. Researchers say the change is already underway, with thousands of new opportunities for viruses to spill over into new species, including humans. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast with Ed Yong, the Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer for The Atlantic. In London, advocates for a people's vaccine rallied outside Pfizer's UK headquarters Thursday, demanding the drug maker end pandemic profiteering and share its vaccine technology with the global south. Activists carried signs reading, "Pharma greed kills and Pfizer has blood on its hands," as they delivered wheelbarrows full of fake cash to the entrance of the building. Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine is one of the most lucrative pharmaceutical products in history, earning the company some $37 billion last year alone, or over $1,000 a second. In a statement, the group Global Justice Now responded, quote, "This is scandalous when more than 8 in 10 people in low-income countries still haven't had a COVID-19 vaccine," unquote. The World Health Organization warns cases of measles rose nearly 80% in the first 2 months of this year after millions of children missed out on routine vaccinations due to the coronavirus pandemic. Measles cases are skyrocketing in Afghanistan, where the Taliban government says at least 16,000 children have been infected so far this year, leading to at least 130 deaths there. Human rights groups are sounding the alarm over a surge of executions in Iran. In 2021, at least 333 people were put to death, a rise of 25% from the previous year, according to the Norway-based Iran Human Rights and France's Together Against the Death Penalty. About a third of those executions were for drug-related offenses. Groups say many of these cases lack sufficient evidence or relied heavily on confessions obtained through torture. The Oklahoma legislature has approved another Republican-led bill banning abortions after just 6 weeks of pregnancy. The measure now goes to the Republican governor, Kevin Stitt, who's expected to sign it. The bill is modeled on Texas's anti-abortion law that took effect in September. It allows any state resident to sue doctors who perform abortions or anyone who, quote, aids or abets an abortion, with rewards of at least $10,000 for those who are successful. This comes less than 2 weeks after Governor Stitt signed into law a total ban on abortion in Oklahoma that makes the procedure a felony punishable with up to 10 years in prison and a $100,000 fine. Oklahoma State Senator Kerry Hicks was among minority Democrats who objected to the legislation.
Forbes ranks Oklahoma number 51 out of 50 states for quality of life for women. We don't have any further to fall, and yet we are trying to prove how much worse we can make things for women through these types of legislation.
Georgia Republican Governor Brian Kemp has signed a raft of bills overhauling public education in the state, including one banning books deemed to be offensive from school libraries. Another bill bars classroom discussion of so-called divisive concepts pertaining to race. The Protect Students First Act also empowers an athletic oversight committee to exclude transgender children from playing high school sports. In a statement, Human Rights Campaign wrote, quote, self-serving politicians catering to an extreme portion of their party's base are showing they're willing to harm vulnerable kids who just want to play with their friends, unquote. Meanwhile, Governor Kemp has signed a bill instituting a flat rate for state income taxes that will disproportionately benefit wealthy Georgians. A new analysis of Fortune 100 investor filings shows 19 of the most profitable corporations in the United States are paying little or no federal income tax. The Center for American Progress found AT&T and Dow, Inc. paid zero federal income taxes last year. In fact, despite nearly $30 billion in earnings, AT&T reported a tax refund of $1.2 billion. Meanwhile, Amazon, ExxonMobil, Verizon, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and others paid extremely low tax rates. In related news, shares of Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, rose by over 17% Thursday, making founder Mark Zuckerberg nearly $11 billion wealthier in just one day. President Biden Thursday confirmed he's looking into taking executive action to cancel an unspecified amount of federal student debt in the coming weeks.
Considering dealing with some debt reduction. I am not considering $50,000 debt reduction, but I'm in the process of taking a hard look at whether or not there will be additional debt forgiveness.
In response, the debt collective demanded the White House cancel more student loan debt, writing in a statement, quote, for millions of borrowers, many of whom owe six figures, $10,000 or $50,000 of relief barely provides a dent in the amount of debt they hold. If Biden were to cancel $10,000 for all 45 million borrowers, we'd still have a massive student debt crisis on our hands, they said. Some Democrats and progressive lawmakers have also been pressuring Biden to cancel at least $50,000 in student debt, if not more. This is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking Thursday.
I again call on the president to take action, which he can do on his own, and hit the financial reset button for millions and millions of Americans. President Biden's done the right thing by continuing the moratorium on student loan payments. His actions have saved millions from financial ruin during the COVID crisis. But borrowers don't just need their debts paused. They need them erased.
And the Food and Drug Administration's published its plan to prohibit the sale and manufacturing of menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. Menthol cigarettes are even more addictive and deadly than regular cigarettes. The FDA estimates a ban could save 633,000 lives by 2050, with the benefits felt most in the African-American community, which for years was targeted by Big Tobacco's ad campaigns promoting menthol brands such as Newport and Kool. A 2018 survey found 85% of black smokers prefer menthol cigarettes. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is expressing alarm over safety issues at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine. Russian forces seized the plant in early March after a fight that led to a fire near one of the plant's reactors. This week, the Ukrainian government accused Russia of launching two cruise missiles that flew at low altitudes over the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Ukraine says Russian missiles have also flown over two other nuclear power plants in Ukraine. The IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi described the situation at the plant as a red light blinking issue. Zaporizhia is the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, and it's located in the largest city in southeastern Ukraine, still under Ukrainian control. During a news briefing Thursday in Vienna, Grossi addressed the reports of Russian missiles flying over nuclear power plants.
Any such development, if confirmed, would be extremely serious. I have been saying from the first day of this crisis that the physical integrity of nuclear facilities is an absolute must. And of course, a missile going astray or something like this could have significant, a very significant impact. But we need to go back to Zaporizhia. It's extremely important. In Zaporizhia, you have tens of thousands of nuclear material, plutonium, enriched uranium, and we have to be verifying that. So it's still the open question that we have at the moment.
IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi speaking Thursday after returning from a trip to Ukraine, where he visited the Chernobyl nuclear power station on Monday on the 36th anniversary of the plant's meltdown. Russia seized Chernobyl in late February and occupied the highly contaminated area until late March. Grossi vowed to help Ukraine repair damage caused during Russia's occupation. He praised workers at the plant for helping to prevent what could have been another nuclear disaster.
In this case, what we had was a nuclear safety situation that was not normal, that could have developed into an accident. I think the first credit must go to the operators, to these people here, because they carried on their work in spite of all the difficulties, in spite of the stress, in spite of the fact that they could not be working normally. They continued working as if nothing had happened, so they kept the situation stable, so to speak.
The 1986 Chernobyl nuclear disaster was the worst nuclear meltdown in world history. We're joined now by Alexei Pasyuk. He is deputy director of the Ukrainian NGO EcoAction, where his focus is on energy and nuclear energy. Joining us from Ukraine. Alexei, thanks for being with us once again. Can you talk about this week? I mean, the significance of the 36th anniversary of Chernobyl with the IAEA director coming to mark that. And at the same time, a few days later, these reports that Russian missiles flew very low down over the largest nuclear power complex in Europe at Zaporizhia.
Indeed. Chernobyl is exactly a place which demonstrates what the nuclear industry accident could be, right? It's a huge areas of land which continue to be polluted with radioactive materials. Back in 86, it was a huge impact for people who lived there. You had 100,000 who had to flee. And it was an amazing cost because basically it's still Soviet Union which started to deal with the accident. It's only recently we finally got safe containment of the destroyed reactor, which international community paid over $2 billion. So, yes, and of course, this is particularly kind of a great demonstration that the risk when Russians are coming, Russian army came and occupied Chernobyl power plant. I mean, that's the site where we don't have operating nuclear reactors, so it's less of the risk of the accident of that scale, but we have a spent nuclear fuel there, which could also be destroyed and have a release of radioactive materials in the air. But of course, Zaporizhia, where you have reactors in operation and they continue to work now, is far more dangerous situation also because it was directly attacked. You know, I have to remind that this concern was in place back from 2014 when the war started in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine, and it was just a couple of hundred kilometers away. And there was already then a discussion, what if missile basically goes the wrong way and attack reactors themselves or the nuclear spent storage facility, and we will have a release. What happened is that actually we just had an attack when the site was shelled by Russian tanks, and it was a very serious accident because there are different scenarios of what can go wrong at the nuclear power plant, and you don't necessarily need to be directly heating reactor or storage to cause problem, because these are the systems where you constantly have to cool down the fuel, and if you have an interruption in electricity supply and cooling systems stop operating, you start getting into this accident of fuel melting.
Can you comment on, despite the fact of the risks, there are reports that European nations are embracing the possibility, investing in more nuclear energy to be less reliant on gas and oil. What would this mean? And also, what does it mean for Ukraine? What message do you have for them?
Well, there are a few of these discussions, but I think there are like different voices on that. For example, in Europe, with all the gas crisis, nuclear is being considered as one of the answers. Not so much about building new reactors because it's long and very expensive, but also there is also an option to extend lifetime of existing reactors. Like, and in particular, Germany was looking into these options to not to close reactors which they're supposed to close. And they come up with the kind of assessment that it will not make sense, that the risks associated with nuclear is far bigger than benefit, particularly, for example, in this story with natural gas. The issue is that gas is to a large degree is used for industry and for heating, while that would not be simply compensated by electricity. It's a far more complicated issue. But I think it's interesting that now we have this demonstration of, of a rather theoretical story. It was always theoretical. What happens if there is a military attack on nuclear? And it was never properly considered. It was always seen as something not very realistic. But now everywhere it should be considered as the kind of setting up a nuclear bomb of a kind, let's say, which can become attacked and have destruction. You know, it brings me back to my school time when we have the big independence movement in late 80s in Ukraine, still as a part of Soviet Union. And I was handled, these leaflets on streets of Kyiv where there were map of Ukraine with the reactors being shown. And the article basically was saying, look, Soviet Union, Russia have planted these nuclear bombs on our territory. And of course, it was this post-Chernobyl movement where the whole anti-nuclear movement was very much connected to independence. But now we're basically getting the proofs that it's very real, it's very practical, and that nuclear brings so many security issues that that it doesn't force it. I also would point out on the political leverage that Russia is getting with nuclear technology. We currently have in European Union a number of countries which operate Soviet designed reactors and which are dependent on Russian fuel. So it's similarly to gas. You know, we're constantly we're talking about these gas wars between Ukraine, Russia, Europe, Russia. It was happening for the last couple of decades when they would just cut on supply.
Well, let me ask you something on that issue of Soviet reactors, Russian reactors. The U.S. and Europe are imposing a number of sanctions on Russian oil and gas. Interestingly, the U.S. is not imposing sanctions on Russian uranium, which it imports. Can you comment on this? Do you think it should be included in the sanctions list?
Yes, it certainly should be. I think it's, you know, this war is very important. As West don't want to directly intervene military, it should use these economic tools. And Rosatom, this nuclear Russian company, this is exactly one of the tools which, as I just was saying, Russia is using as political tool internationally. And it should be basically under sanctions as well. There are some of the steps which are happening, for example, in Germany, there are some common joint companies which are reviewing the agreement with Russia, but most of the companies don't. And I think this is also a moment which exposes how much different countries, including U.S., are dependent on Russian nuclear industry. So, yes, I definitely would say that all kind of sanctions on Russian energy supply and nuclear in particular should be implemented. Unfortunately, it's complicated. I think it's a problem that we don't realize the scale. For example, what have happened in last week, that despite there is a ban on the plane flying to Russia from Europe, there was a special agreement to have one plane coming from Russia to Slovakia to bring nuclear fuel. So this is, that shows the scale of this kind of dependence and importance of that.
And you have this incredible irony that, of course, President Zelensky is really pushing hard for sanctions to be imposed by European countries and the U.S. on Russia oil and gas. But you've got the pipelines of Russia going through Ukraine to Europe, and Ukraine is not cutting those off. I think 30% of the fuel that goes through there, 30% of Europe's fuel that goes through there is through Ukraine.
Yeah, but because, I mean, it would be probably wrong politically for Ukraine now dictate Europe whether it buys it or not. It asks, right? Of course, it's important to maintain it there, especially in the situation when the way out is really defeating Russia on the ground, which Ukraine is struggling to do. And it brings us back to the situation in Zaporizhia. You know, the reality is that we cannot guarantee nuclear safety in Ukraine unless the war is over. And we have to remember that Russian army is still staying at Zaporizhia power plant, which is still operating. And the issue is we don't know how it will be over, because now it's a kind of a situation of some kind of unclear stability when we don't know what is happening on the station, but there is not active combat is happening. But at certain moment, Russian troops will need to retreat, and we don't know how it will be happening.
Alexei, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Alexei Pasyuk, Deputy Director of the Ukrainian NGO EcoAction, focusing on energy and particularly nuclear energy. Please be safe speaking to us from Western Ukraine. Next up, we go to the Pulitzer Prize-winning Atlantic journalist Ed Yong about the the pandemicine, how the climate emergency could spark the next pandemic. Stay with us. Jade by Pierre-Octave Ferru. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S. COVID death toll approaches 1 million, we turn now to look at how the climate emergency could spark the next pandemic. A new study published in Nature shows the climate crisis and urban sprawl is forcing many wild mammals to relocate to new habitats where they interact with new species, including humans, leading to more viruses spilling over from one species to another. The researchers say the shuffling of viruses and mammals has already started and will increase as the Earth continues to warm. We're joined now by the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ed Yong. He writes about the study in his new piece for The Atlantic, headlined, "We Created the Pandemicine." Welcome back, Ed, to Democracy Now! Why don't you start off by just explaining, what do you mean by the pandemicine? This is a terrifying article.
So the idea is actually pretty straightforward and intuitive. As the world warms, the world's animals are being forced to relocate into new habitats to track their preferred environmental conditions. As they do this, species that never before coexisted will suddenly find themselves close neighbors, and that gives the viruses that those species carry opportunities to hop into new hosts. So in a warming world, we'll get lots of these spillover events in which viruses find new hosts, mostly transferring between animal to animal, but increasing the odds that they will eventually then spill over into us. This new study led by Colin Carlson and Greg Albury shows that the extent of these events is huge and that they, crucially, that they have already been going on in a very substantial way and in a way that is going to be very difficult for us to address. So we're used to talking about the Anthropocene, this era of the planet's history where it's dominated by human influence. We are also then living through the pandemicine, this era where our lives are going to be repeatedly affected by new and re-emergent diseases that will occur more frequently because of the climatic changes that we have also unleashed upon the world.
Can you explain the simulation that the scientists of this study created to show the potential hotspots of future viral sharing, as they put it?
So what they did was to look at maps of where some 3,000 mammal species are now and where they're likely going to be in warmer worlds under various conditions of projected warming. And then they'll take different pairs of mammals and look at where those ranges overlap in ways that they currently don't, and then predict how often those overlaps will lead to the kinds of spillovers that I've talked about. It's a huge effort. No study like this has been attempted before, and it took them 3 years over the course of the current pandemic to do it. But the results are very stark and quite grim. So, for example, it turned out that the hotspots for future spillovers are going to lie in the tropics, areas that are diverse in species and tend to be quite mountainous, so a lot of tropical Africa and Southeast Asia. They're going to disproportionately happen in areas that are basically in humanity's backyard, areas that are going to be heavily settled by people that are already sites of human cities or will be in the near-term future. And I think the most worrying part of this is that the simulations show that these trends have already been going on, and that even if all greenhouse emissions, even if all carbon emissions cease today, that this is a train that once set in motion cannot be halted, that we have already started this and it's already underway in this world that has warmed by 1.2 degrees. Of course, there are many other great reasons to try and mitigate climate change as much as possible, but the pandemicine, once released, cannot be easily unbottled, which means that we're now in a position where we have to expect more of what we're currently going through and try and prepare for it and adapt for it.
So, Ed, if you can use the example of Ebola and talk about bats and how they are affected by climate change and what it means for just Ebola.
So bats are very good at, so bats fly, obviously, and that allows them to travel over much longer distances than other mammals, which means that they are particular drivers for the kinds of spillover effects linked to climate change that I've talked about. No one really knows the exact reservoir species for Ebola in the wild, but it's likely to be a bat, and there's 13 possible species. Those species in the future are going to travel, and they're going to create lots and lots of opportunities for their viruses to spill over into a lot of other mammals. And what that means for Ebola, which is currently a problem mostly for Western Africa and a little bit for the East, is that it's likely going to be a problem for other parts of the continent too. It might well become a problem that a significant problem that Eastern Africa also needs to worry about. And you know, this is Ebola. It's one disease. This is likely going to be the case for every animal-borne virus that bothers us, including the many tens of thousands that we haven't even discovered yet. This is a global problem. It is a problem not just driven particularly by bats, but not just of bats. It's going to be hotspots in places like Africa and Southeast Asia, but not just there. It's a planetary problem. We really have rewired the network of animals and viruses in a very dramatic way, and in a way that's going to be to our detriment. The way I think about this is, for a new virus to spill over into humans, a lot of things need to line up, all of which are quite unlikely. The viruses need to find intermediate hosts. Those intermediate hosts need to be near people. The viruses need to be compatible enough to affect us. All of these have quite low odds. So it's like playing Russian roulette with a gun that has a million chambers in it. But because we've altered the climate, because we've warmed to the world, we've effectively loaded bullets into more of those chambers, and we're now starting to pull the trigger more frequently. We do that enough, we're going to get shot.
So what added to the terror in your piece? I mean, these guys, the scientists who did the Nature study, assumed the changes they simulated were occur in the later half of this century. But instead, their simulation suggested, and when they did it over and over, we could be living through the peak era of spillovers right now. So talk more about that, and specifically about COVID.
Right. So it's very hard to take any particular virus like SARS-CoV-2 that causes COVID and say this is a climate-related thing. It's very hard to take the present and then backtrack into the past. But what the simulation shows is that these kinds of events are just going to be more likely. So whether or not climate was the thing that whether or not climate influenced the emergence of COVID as a disease, it's going to influence the emergence of many similar kinds of events now and in the future. And as we've said, these events have been going on. The risk has been growing beneath our noses, which means that we're now in a situation where we simply have to deal with it. The moment for averting this was a few decades ago. What we're forced to do now is to cope with the consequences. And that means a few things. We can do predictive and preventive work. There are things that we can try and better understand and predict which kinds of viruses are going to spill over into us. We can prepare vaccines ahead of time. We can set up surveillance systems in the kind of future hotspots that this study identified. But no amount of that is going to mean that no amount of that will negate the risk of pandemics fully. We must expect new diseases to hit us and hit us in the imminent future. The fact that we're going through one society upending crisis that we all want to get past right now doesn't give us a pass. We could start the next pandemic tomorrow, or it could have happened already. And that means that we need to prepare in ways that we seem to be loath to do. We need to shore up our public health infrastructure. We need to make sure that our healthcare system is ready. We need social safety nets so that the most marginalized and vulnerable people don't get disproportionately hit by whatever comes next, as they have by every epidemic in the recent past. We need to do all those things. And if we are blessed enough to get a lull from COVID, we need to use that time to prepare for future onslaughts of other epidemics, because what this study makes very abundantly clear is that those will happen. People have always predicted that we're going to live through an age of more and more epidemics and outbreaks. This study confirms that that is true. And I think what it absolutely does is show that many of the greatest existential threats to our world right now, like climate change, the rise of new diseases, and the sixth mass extinction of wildlife, are really all facets of the same problem. And we need to think of that in that same interconnected way.
Ed Yong, we want to thank you for being with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer at The Atlantic. We will link to your piece, "We Created the Pandemicine." Coming up, The Wobblies. May Day is Sunday. We'll look at a classic film that tells the story of the IWW, the industrial workers of the world. Stay with us.
You have mansions of gold in the sky and live in a shack away in the back. Would you have wings up in heaven to fly and starve here with rags on your back?
Written by Joe Hill, from the 1979 documentary The Wobblies. Among the voices you just heard in that musical break, Alice Gerard, Joe Glazer, and Mike Seeger, the half-brother of Pete Seeger. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This Sunday, much of the world will celebrate May Day, International Workers' Day. Amidst a wave of union organizing in the United States that includes scores of Starbucks stores and the newly formed Amazon Labor Union, we end today's show with a film that tells the story of the first union for all workers. The Wobblies is a documentary that came out in 1979 and has just been restored and entered into the Library of Congress's National Film Registry.
Your name?
Sam Scarlett.
What's your religion?
The IWW.
That ain't no religion.
The only one I got.
Are you a citizen?
No, I'm an industrial worker of the world.
One who is a working man could not be denied membership for any reason, as long as he was an actual wage worker, race, creed, color, any reason. Sex, whatever.
Industrial workers of the world, work, good wages, and respect. That's what they wanted for the workers. To be people, not nobody.
In the grain fields, we harvested every major grain that grew in North America. Wheat, oats, barley, rye.
The heat was 110 to 112 to 114 degrees temperature out in the sun. And you could look across the plains and see a freight train for miles away.
The Wobblies, featuring oral histories with elderly former members of the IWW who are in their 80s and 90s in the 1970s. It's narrated by the late Roger Baldwin, one of the founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, who died in 1981. This is another clip.
But unskilled labor had almost no representation, whatever. AFL didn't take in unskilled workers, and they had no voice to speak for them. It was these conditions that were largely responsible for the founding of the industrial workers of the world.
The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the earth and the machinery of production, and abolish the wage system.
I remember reading of the founding convention of the industrial workers of the world, which took place in Chicago in 1905, and headed by men who were already well known to newspaper readers, Big Bill Haywood, for instance, of the Western Federation of Miners, and Eugene B. Debs, candidate for president on the Socialist Party ticket, and Mother Jones, and many others.
Fellow workers, this is the Continental Congress of the working class. I don't give a snap of my fingers whether skilled workers join this union or not. We don't need them. There are 35 million workers in this country that aren't organized yet. What we want to establish at this time is an organization that will open wide its doors to every man or woman that earns his livelihood by brain or muscle.
The words of IWW leader Big Bill Haywood in the film The Wobblies. For more, we're joined by the Academy Award-winning filmmaker Deborah Schaefer, who co-directed this remarkable documentary with Stuart Byrd in 1979. It's just been restored and screens nationwide on May Day, this Sunday, online at the end of May. Deborah, welcome to Democracy Now! It's an astounding film. Tell us the story of The Wobblies.
Well, the Wobblies themselves was a union, as you heard in the clip. It was founded in 1905 out of necessity, really. There were the workers at that time, unskilled workers, had no unions. There was no such thing. The AFL existed, but they only admitted and organized skilled workers, mostly white, mostly male, bricklayers, masons, people with highly skilled jobs. So the masses of industrial workers. Remember, this was the early days of industrialization in the United States. The textile mills were booming, the lumber mills were booming, the cotton gins were booming. The workers had no representation at all, and they were being expected to work 7 days a week, 12-hour days, no breaks, no meals, underpaid, overworked. Children were working. Conditions were terrible and intolerable.
I wanted to go back to your film. In this clip, we hear from black longshoreman James Fair after, one of the founders of the ACLU, Roger Baldwin.
in the ports of the Atlantic and of the Gulf Coast, black and white workers were organized in the same unions, which the AFL and the established unions did not permit.
Well, we owned the farm, and conditions were just bad. My parents heard of Pennsylvania, and so to speak, well, you could rake up money out of the street, and they decided, you know, to come north. Getting jobs as far as the Negroes or black is concerned was pretty rough, and the IWW was the only thing it was accepting Negro or black workers, you know, freely. We had Fletcher, he was a Negro, and we had one Niff, he was white, but he was a very dedicated union man. Both of these men, we would have our pep talks and whatnot, and Fletcher, after he make a speech or something other, solidarity, all for one and one for all. We were given the roughest jobs, of course. They would have a rough job even on deck. And if a white came along, why, I didn't have no job. I'd had to go back to something else. The work was so rough, we had to use hand trucks, and two men would load that truck, freight. We'd have to truck it over very rough floors to the side of the ship to be loaded. We worked 10 hours, and people were getting hurt one after another. Just going to the hospital, we had no medical safety rules or anything like that. When the contract ran out, we'd go in for a contract, nothing doing. We had to go out on strike. The results of that, while we were on strike, people were transported from different parts of the country to break strikes. Some would be having, you know, guns as same as they were the law, and they would be, these vans going down, they would be escorted by police escorts on motorcycles. And a striker would have as much chance before the strike breakers as a rabbit would have before a gunner.
Black longshoreman James Fair. I want to go to another clip of the Wobblies. The IWW was creative with its tactics. In this clip, we hear from migratory workers Joe Murphy and Jack Miller.
Another one of the IWW tactics was sabotage, which was anything from slowing down on the job to threatening violence, which they didn't practice, as a matter of fact, but it certainly scared employers into thinking they did.
If Freedom's Road seems rough and hard and strewn with rocks and thorns, just put your wooden shoes on pard, then you won't hurt your corns. To organize and teach, no doubt, is very good, that's true, but still you cannot get along without the good old wooden shoe. The wooden shoe is a symbol of the Sabbath. The Sabbath was the French, and the French worker, when he wanted to rest, he'd throw his Sabbath in the machinery and would break it down, and that's where the word sabotage came from.
Now, if you want to know what a sabotage really means, it don't mean, as the French used the word, sabot, throw a wooden shoe into the machine. Nor did it mean burning down sawmills. For what is the reason, what would be the sense in burning down your source of employment?
What would it sabotage mean?
The conscious withdrawal of efficiency.
I mean, that's another clip from the Wobblies. It is amazing, Deborah Schaefer, that you found these workers now in their, at the time, not, I mean, now many of them are dead, of course, in their 80s and 90s, had a hard time finding coal miners, right, because they were mostly all dead.
Yeah, I think our most, finding James Fair, the longshoreman from Philadelphia, was our most challenging. Remember, we made this film in the late 70s. There was no internet. We couldn't put out a call through social media. We actually created a leaflet that we had people hand out on the docks in Philadelphia, a physical, like, color-printed paper leaflet saying, was your grandfather a Wobbly? because we knew that there had to be still black workers living in Chicago and Philadelphia who had been part of the union. And we eventually found James through, I think, a church that he was a member of, a minister knew and led us to him. And so the search for the people was, we weren't sure when we started how many people we would find. We knew we had a few in the area around New York, and we just didn't know if we'd find, 10 or 20 still alive. I mean, in 1977, the union had been founded in 1905. So we were, people, as you said, were already very elderly. They're all gone. I want to
go back to another clip. I mean, this film is so good. The archival footage is unbelievable as well. In this clip, it's 1917, and World War I had begun. We hear from Roger Baldwin, the founder of the American Civil Liberties Union, a narrator of this, and Wobbly's Jack Miller, Nils Pedersen, and Tom Scribner. It begins with the words of then American Federation of Labor President Sam Gompers.
This is the people's war, labor's war. The final outcome will be determined in the factories, the shops, the mines, the farms, the production and transportation agencies of the various countries. The workers have a part in this war equal with our fighting boys.
The American Federation of Labor, which, of course, was the established union and very patriotic, and engaged in an agreement with the government not to strike during war. The IWW would not subscribe to that. War production required immense quantities of timber, and the IWW really controlled the great timber areas of the Northwest, therefore attracting the government's attention, particularly when the IWW engaged in strikes against the conditions under which logging was done.
The general strike developed in the summer of 1917, and it spread up and down the Pacific Coast. And it was led by the IWW.
In summer of 1917, the woods were almost solidly organized. The lumberjack, the most individualistic workers as you can think of, the big man idea, Paul Bunyan complex. Now the solidarity was such, not one logger remained in the camps wherever we could get in communication with that camp to tell them that the strike was on.
50,000 lumberjacks, 50,000 packs, 50,000 dirty rolls of blankets on their backs, 50,000 minds made up to strike and strike like men. For 50 years they packed a bed, but never will again.
They tried every way to break up the strike. They sent soldiers in there. Soldiers that never had an axe in their hand. They didn't know they'd get lost if they walked around a big stump.
They organized the spruce division. That's the way they used the army as strike breakers.
They called them the Loyal Legion of Loggers. We called them the Lousy Long-Legged Loggers. Wave the flag with one hand and rob you with the other.
Another clip of the Wobblies. The director, Deborah Schaefer, is with us. There is so much to talk about. But if you could talk about what happened to them in World War I, the Palmer raids, and their relationship with the more establishment AFL.
Well, the AFL wanted absolutely nothing to do with the IWW, of course. They saw them as a threat, although I have to say that later, to skip over to the end of it, what you're asking me about, the IWW really was the precursor to the CIO. Many, many IWW organizers went on to become organizers for the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Unions, which did represent unskilled workers and was organized in the 30s. The Wobblies were put out of business by the federal government. There's just no other way to put it. I learned how, in the process of making the film, how really deep and dreadful the repression from the government was. Similar to, like, lately we've seen there was a film a couple of years ago about the murder of Fred Hampton, which had been organized by the FBI. And this was a very similar attack on the IWW, organized by, you mentioned, A. Mitchell Palmer, who was the head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation at the time. His Eager Beaver young assistant was J. Edgar Hoover. And they arrested people right and left. They deported any immigrant workers. Anybody who didn't have their citizenship papers were just put on boats and deported out of the U.S., never to be allowed to return. 101 members and mostly leadership people all across the country were arrested in 1917 during the war. They were arrested and charged with sedition, put in jail. In the end, it was a sham trial. And
we have 15 seconds.
They were charged with, they were given 20 years in prison for having organized the IWW. I just want to say I find, shockingly, the film is more relevant now than it was when we released it in 79.
And it's being put into the Library of Congress's National Film Registry, which is incredible, soon to be available to everyone, opening on May Day, which is Sunday. That does it for today's show. Deborah Schaefer, I want to thank you for being with us, co-director with Stuart Bird of the 1979 documentary The Wobblies, that's just being released once again. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Happy May Day, everyone. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Happy May Day from Kenny Joe.
Stand up, all victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing if you have no rights. Let racist ignorance be ended, for respect makes the empires fall. Freedom is merely privilege extended unless enjoyed by one and all. So brothers and sisters, for the struggle carries on. The Internationale unites the world in song. So dawn and stand beside us. We'll live together or we'll die alone. In our world poisoned by exploitation, no sooner will take on, they must give and end the vanity of nations. We hope one earth on which to live.
Well, I hope this isn't a day when we have just one CD player. I hope, I don't know if I hope it's the CD, not the CD player. It's my CD, it's not my CD player. Anyhow, not a good way to start. That was Billy Bragg, of course, doing the Internationale off of his CD by the same name. Thought that would be a good follow-up to Amy. What we're going to do for the rest of the day is we're going to play some more labor songs. We'll even play a wobbly song. We'll do that plus some new music. May Day is Sunday, and Tomorrow, though, is Kenny Joe's favorite May Day celebration, the Polish Hill May Day Parade, making a comeback after 2 years' absence. It'll be starting at the end of Melwood Avenue, the Oakland end of Melwood Avenue. People will be gathering at noon. No, I heard people be gathering. It used to be noon. I think maybe it's 11:30 now. Anyhow, it's your guess is as good as well, it's probably not as good as mine as to when the parade will start, but probably start sometime between noon and 1 o'clock. That's Kenny Joe's guess. Rain or shine, but from what I hear, there won't be any rain. And if you can't make that, then there's another May Day parade in Squirrel Hill on the actual May Day, Sunday. I believe that steps off from Forbes and Murray at 3 o'clock. So, hope you can make it to one or both of those. Before we play any more music here, let me get a PSA out of the way. In an effort to minimize accidental shootings and help all residents be responsible gun owners, the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police is providing free gun locks for all Pittsburgh residents, while supplies last, of course. The locks are available at all zones within the city and at police headquarters on Western Avenue. Gun locks are a crucial part of the effort to curb accidental shootings.